Hey everyone, welcome to my most recent episode of Ag Uncensored with your host, me, Nathan Folaiti here. I got Michael Ott here today, who I actually kind of just, we were going to plan on doing a podcast regardless, but I've been sick this week and I had to cancel someone else. And so I messaged Michael last minute, literally a few hours ago as I'm doing this, and here we are, and he's available. And so while it was the plan, we're just doing a little earlier. But anyways, Michael, thanks for that and coming on. You've had a nice little storied past and more recently in ag tech doing a bunch of stuff. But before we get into that, why don't you tell everybody about who you are, what you do, how you got into ag and the tech side and whatever else. The board is yours.
Thanks for having me. I'm really happy this worked out because you're right. We had planned on doing it. It just popped up a little sooner than anticipated. So that's wonderful. Right now, I'm the CEO of Sequesta. We harness the power of plants to push roots deeper and store carbon underground. So that's using gene editing technology based out of the Salk Institute in San Diego. And we are bringing this into commodity crop agriculture, where we'll use that gene editing technology, push roots deeper, that'll help plants tolerate stress, and then like a drought, and then we can also generate carbon credits for farmers with no change in their agronomic practices. So that's pretty exciting. Most recently before this, I founded Rantizo. That's the nation's largest drone spraying company. So Rantizo is about 35 states now, rocking and rolling, doing really well. We're excited about all the opportunities that are happening there. Seems like drone application is really becoming way, way more common than when I started the company 6 years ago. And then to answer your first question about how I got into ag, I grew up in a small town in Iowa. We had a restaurant, so we weren't technically on the farm, but the majority of our clientele was on the farm, and everybody that I went to a very small Catholic high school was on the farm. So I got to go out and bale hay and help out with them. So it was affiliated with it, but not directly there, and just got to know how to talk to people and understand what was going on and what was important, you know, what mattered. And so it was really interesting to see all those things that I learned early on growing up, got a chemistry master's degree, and then ended up helping people do some fundraising for ethanol and biodiesel plants because I had worked for a hedge fund right out of grad school. So I knew about finance, I knew about science, and then harkening back to all those conversations I had with many, many, many farmers, I could talk to them as well. So kind of could bridge the gap between all those different universes.
Well, that's quite a bit to do there. So I remember when you first started kind of the Rantizo thing, it's kind of funny because I remember you probably didn't know it was me. At the time, I don't know if it was on Twitter or on something else. Maybe it was Ag Talk or something. You're kind of talking about the spraying stuff, and you know, naturally, all the drone stuff was kind of a craze for a while and a way to get into it. And you guys are kind of the first to kind of maybe more push the spraying thing, and naturally, that's a big kind of barrier when you got, you know, aerial applicators and all the, you know, retailers doing their own spraying and trying to match up to that. So kind of, you know, with that landscape, what made you decide to get into drones and then spraying? Like, what was the kind of the step up to that?
Yeah. So I used to do corporate venture capital. So we had funding from Monsanto, Novozymes, and Bunge to do early stage agriculture and energy investments, and started a company that I actually deployed in India. It was a biological seed treatment for rice. So it put a tiny amount of nitrogen on a rice seed at the exact right moment. It was naturally sticky, it was natural, everything else. It was a great idea. That one had an unusual exit. That's a better story for a beer, but ended up giving me enough money to kind of think about what's the next thing to do. And with that technology, I could put nitrogen on rice at the right time, and that was perfect. But only that input, only that crop. Sure. And I was thinking about how do I do it in a in any crop at any time. And drone application was, this is like 2017, 2018. So drones were pretty small, pretty unreliable at those times. And but I thought they were getting better, and that's the type of thing that improves rapidly. So kind of had that core of an idea about, just doing the right amount at the exact right moment. In 2017, 2018, not many people were talking about that then. So we kind of got ahead of the game there.
Well, and what was always kind of, for me, I always thought, I mean, you would see it even in movies. I can't remember what movie it is. It was a futuristic movie, and there was someone actually farming, and they hit the button, and it sprayed drones. It was
Yeah, there was
also like a post-op apocalyptic. I'm gonna just murder that word.
You're good.
There was a world war of sorts going on, and
Yep.
anyways, but now it's actually been getting to reality, and some farms even are buying their own, and of course there's still some challenges, but I've actually been kind of surprised over the last, yeah, I suppose 2 years. It's just kind of really launched up into more realistic realms. What's done that? What's made that possible more so than like the early days?
I think it's the reliability of the drone, and people are realizing there are certain times where a drone is way better to do an application than a tractor. There's many other times that a tractor is way better than a drone. So it's just like another tool in your toolbox, and finding that opportunity and then deploying it the right time, the right moment, using that tool. So Purdue does that study every year in terms of intentions of what ag retailers are going to buy. And the numbers, I'm pretty close on these. It was like 19% of ag retailers had drones or intended to, and they plan to go up from 33 to 55% over the next couple of years. So like half of all our ag retailers are going to have some sort of drone application operation. So that's the thing that people are seeing. I can make money doing this. And with the same thing with
Well,
sequestration, like you can talk about the carbon angle and everything else there, but ultimately you have to make money doing those things. And once you can do that, then things really take off. You'll get the early adopters, people that want something cool. We had a guy early on at Rantizo that he bought a drone to spray in his 1 acre vineyard that he had in his backyard because he thought it was really cool. And he wanted us to come set it up. All he wanted to do was click the button. And in 2018, 2019, that was a pretty tall ask because we're still getting it all figured out. However, now, with Rantizo, we've done almost 200,000 acres of application last year. So a wide range of crops, wide range of settings, everything else, all those things are tracked and it's known. So then like, oh, how do you spray this fungicide on wheat? How do you do a cover crop application, around the river bend? How do you do that? Like, okay, we've got data on all those things. So you can do that. And it's the power of a network effect that has really come together. So now with our software that's coming out, the ability to do Acre Connect, where you can, if you've got a need for an application, get on, it's geotagged. So if we have somebody close by, you can order that up, and those things are interesting and able to actually work now. A funny story about the setup of that. Early on, someone said, "Hey, let's put together a website. If somebody wants an application by drone, we can set it up." So we put it out there. It's like, this is awesome. Easy to do on the web. Super great. We had like 85 hits in the first week, and two of them are things that we could have feasibly done, and realized, okay, there's a lot of demand for this. But we cannot service that in 2019. And now we're getting pretty good, especially with geotagging and everything else and knowing where things are. But it's just everything improves as you do it over time.
Well, and what's been I think it's been good to see some of the drone spraying having some success here, because clearly there's been other things in ag tech that haven't, even the drone side with taking imagery, like that was always a it was always kind of a weird, I have a love-hate relationship with drones, because being from the satellite imagery world, when they started kind of flooding in 14, 15, I mean, there was, I mean, heck, we had some contracts with some big input suppliers and bigger groups. And then like all of a sudden, just because of the marketing maybe pitch, it was like overnight, like, well, no, we'll get all our imagery from drones. And then it was in papers and the news, like national news type stuff, mm-hmm. talking about it. And it's like, well, yeah, they fit in the right spot. But if you want XYZ, you know, you have to use the right thing. And that just, oh, it yeah, like I said, a love hate, but I always knew it always has a place. Cause And one of the areas I always thought was the spraying side. Of course, there's, like you said, there's all the other challenges, you know, the amount of liquid and how it's actually applied, you know, even the how the air pushes down is different than a plane. It's different than a helicopter. There's all those things. And then just, I mean, the right to fly a drone with all the rules and regulations, that was its own challenge. But the one area when I farmed and you know, my friends and family that farm, I mean, when you actually look at a field, there's not weeds or disease everywhere. Sometimes it's spread, you know, a lot, depending on how long you skipped from doing something about it. But I always thought, I was like, okay, let's get, or even with the camera side, let's get drones to fly where they should, instead of where they shouldn't. And I mean, I know there's broad application on the spraying side, but I always thought it's like, okay, with like fungicide maps who do with satellites, it's like, we only need them in the high vegetative areas. Just fly there, just do those areas. And then you don't have to cover all the field. You don't have to run a $500,000 sprayer up and down and mm-hmm. waste a bunch of chemical and time. I think it's getting there. Is it to that point yet? Or is just people are kind of afraid of that? More site-specific spraying, I guess.
I'll never forget a conversation I had with a guy. It was at an ag retailer event. And I said, you can use a drone and just spray a portion of the field. And he's like, what do you mean? Like, you only spray part of, why would anyone only ever spray part of the field? Like, spray the whole damn thing. And it's like, well, you know, this is, again, 2019, 2020. And I, that was a revolutionary concept to some people. And now people are grasping, yes, absolutely, you should, you know, maximize your input costs in terms, or optimize your input costs by just spraying where things are needed. And it comes down to a system approach. And that's, I think, mm-hmm. where we were successful at Rantizo. And that's what we're trying to build at Sequesta, is like understanding the system, where it's not just a drone. It's the trailer, the reloading device, insurance, mm-hmm. permitting, support, and now software, where it's just, we've got to get an as applied map and an as covered map. So I applied on 13 of these 60 acres. So I've got precisely where that was applied. I've covered 60. So then you can kind of figure it out from there. But making all those systems work, that's what I found is my specialty, is, okay, here's a problem. Let's find a technology that works and then put the system around it, so everyone up and down the value chain can benefit from that. And that's what we're trying to do at Sequesta.
Well, and yeah, I mean, it might be a good segue into it, that part. Cause I mean, we could talk about drone spraying probably for the next entire hour too, which, I mean, I still find fascinating, and I've dabbled with a few. There was a group this fall, they're wanting to build one that lifts 1,000 pounds, mm-hmm. And can do basically the same amount of work as a aerial applicator, but I mean, they're very expensive, and the mechanics of it get quite extensive and overall. But yeah, to your point, like why that ag retailer was like, why you just spray the whole field? I suppose that's the other problem with some of the more site specific drone spraying is, well, ag retailers want to sell more chemical because they make a lot of money off that too. So they want to spray the whole field.
Well, exactly. And it's understanding the system that you're in. And yeah, an ag retailer that's going to make more money spraying the whole field, that's what they'll do. Can you upcharge and then, you know, actually show the farmer that there's value in doing this and you know, save your time, have the ability to once again spray 13 of those 60 acres, and then I'll do this 60, that 60, boom, 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 and I'm actually knocking out more territory as you go. And that's where I think that systems point of view of what we're trying to do now at Sequesta is like understanding our edits and then how does that fit in a agricultural channel to market that can really make economic sense for the seed companies, the ag retailers, and the farmers, and the carbon buyers that are getting it at the end too. So that's where my head is right now.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll skip away from drone spraying for now as now you're onto your next kind of venture. And then we'll walk into that. And then I think maybe we can walk into kind of just the whole generalities of ag tech and your thoughts and experiences and how it's changing. Because clearly a lot is changing. So, but yeah, talk about the Sequesta side a little more and how you got into that. And it's an interesting novel concept too. It's different from when we've talked about before of dealing with kind of the carbon mantra in ag. I mean, there's a lot of ways people are trying to deal with it, from cover crops to sequestration to insets, you know, it's onsets versus insets, all these fun things, government regulations, groups trying it. But there's been issues with it because it's been hard to kind of measure, you know, the MRV side is complicated. And there needs to be more of an approach where it feels more common sense in how someone's sequestering carbon. That's been kind of how I've thought about it. And yeah, so talk about what you're doing more, because I think it can kind of fit into there, because it's
yeah, that's our goal, is to fit right into the existing systems. So we're doing gene editing of traits, and so we can do root architecture modification. I can change the root to do whatever you want. We're choosing to go with deeper roots because that's universally desirable in agriculture. Helpful in a drought because you can get down lower in the water table. Mm-hmm. Helpful in excess rain because that excess rain is a wash down nutrients. So we're going deeper. We could go shallower, wider, fatter, narrower, branched, not branched, you name it. So that's what we're doing, just modifying roots to go deeper. And the benefits there are, there's additionality because this is a new trait that's going to be in the seed. So technically there's something new that's needed for the carbon credit. Anything has to be additional. You know, mm-hmm. Some people complain about, you know, if you have been doing cover crops for years, you can't get that credit. If you just started doing it, then that's additional, then you do get the credit. So everything that we're doing is additional. So that's really helpful. But then other than that, we don't want to change anything else at all in the system. So that's where I think a lot of these carbon programs have failed, in they're asking for a whole bunch of changes for a credit that's not very deep and not very valuable. So it's like, do $25 to $40 worth of work for $5 to $10 of carbon credit.
Share all this data that, you know, 10 years worth of data and your APH history, which I don't know many farmers that like to share their APH history, because that's like the actual yield that they want to keep away from everybody, but that's what some require. And I mean, the other point where I think it's kind of interesting in how you're approaching it is you're going after kind of more of the gene side. So it's multiple crops, and it also is not just about sequestering carbon. Like you said, it put the roots down deeper, and that's been some crops, sunflowers, which are growing a lot up here, their roots go super deep. Mm-hmm. They'll also suck the water out of the whole entire field, but they'll get some of that deep water, you know, some of those taproot type things. You know, corn will go deeper, but, you know, wheat stays up here. So I think it's interesting where you can, if you can balance it for where that field needs it, even if it doesn't have to do with sequestering, just water use or nitrogen efficiency, things like that. You can start site specific, you know, putting different varieties where the roots go different places. I mean, that's probably a little ways away, but
we're thinking along the exact same lines. So yeah, our view is, you know, get the seeds into the seed company, you know, we'll license to them. They do those deals all the time, mm-hmm. and then distribute through the normal channels. And then a farmer will just plant as they always have. And we'll need a tiny amount of data to say, basically, I bought this seed. The seed has the trait. I've planted it and harvested it. Like, that's all that I care about. I'm not getting into yield. I'm not getting in the data selling business. Mm-hmm. I don't want to mess around there. I need like verification that you had the seed and it was in the ground and it actually grew. Like, that's all that we care about. So,
well, that's pretty similar to how people have dealt with it with Roundup traits, exactly, and stuff like that, yep, anyways. So that's a pretty normal, yep, it's a pretty normal ask. And I think, you know, anything in the ag tech space, that's something maybe that wasn't done as much, and let's say more recently, is making it just not a barrier to do things as normal. Because some of these things, you have to change like everything about it. Like you said, on the carbon side, traditionally, mm-hmm, how it's been. If you can add technology in ways where farmers don't even know they're really doing it, but they see multiple benefits from, traditionally that works.
Yep. Yeah, we had one of our new investors, like, you know, we really like transformational technologies. Like, how are you transforming agriculture? It's like, we're deliberately not. We're going through the traditional seed selling channels to farmers as they always have, because if I'm asking someone to do a whole sort of new thing, that hurts your adoption and hurts your scale. Yeah. And we're trying to solve a giant problem here. And it's very challenging to ask people to change practices. I do have a good stat at the beginning of our presentation where we talk about nature absorbs and releases about 750 gigatons of carbon each year. Humans emit about 40 gigatons of carbon. So if I want to solve for excess carbon in the atmosphere, I can either convince every human to use half as much, eat half as much, drive half as much, 50% reduction, or I can make nature 2.5% more efficient. So I think it's, mm-hmm, much more likely that we make nature more efficient than get every single person in the world to use half as much of all the products that they use. Like, that's never going to happen. So we want to make, yeah, tiny changes to giant markets and scale through that. And that's where I think the true value play will come in.
Well, I mean, that playbook is basically what the major providers have done, especially with seed genetics anyways, is, that's how you change some of those things. You know, most of the, you could call it, you know, pollution and things like that are caused by what they say, like the top 100 largest companies in the world. Well, if you want to change them, you need to come out with things that work with their systems that do that change, that are also not barriers to how they do business.
Yep. And everyone, yeah, at every step has to make money. Like, that's the seed company,
capitalism,
has to, yeah, retailer does, the farmer. So that's the system that I'm trying to put together. And we've got some pretty good ways about it where we actually want to license the trait to seed companies, and then we don't want the farmer to pay for it. Yeah. It just isn't one more trait that they can add in at that seed purchase time. And then with that free trait, you know, probably labeled deep root / carbon sequestration, I think that'll really help with adoption. And then as we get, you know, the initial value of the carbon that we get is going to be fairly low. But, you know, if you're paying zero for something and you get $2, you know, per acre, great. If you get 8, 12, 15, 30, even better. Obviously, I want that number to be as high as possible. But I think early on, if we can get this out there at no charge to the farmer, and then when the carbon is sold at the end, kind of pay them back through the system, that'll just kind of build on itself. Because what we're learning in the measurement reporting verification is that what we can prove after 1 year is going to be a fraction of the total amount of carbon that's there. So I might, mm-hmm, only be able to pay 10%, 30% of the total amount that's in there. But in years 2, 3, 4, 5, okay, those checks are going to keep coming in. And then as you plant more crops, you'll kind of stack this on top of each other. So ultimately, it'll pay back pretty nicely. And I think farmers will really appreciate, you know, not paying anything for that up front. And I think that's a kind of a different model, because, you know, most people do that 2-to-1, 3-to-1 type of ratio of, mm-hmm, I'm creating $30 in value, I can charge $10 for it. So it'd be hard for us to do that early on with our, you know, just adding a dollar per bag of seed or whatever it may be. And yeah, it's $3, but all right, that'll be hurting with adoption, I think.
Yeah. So how will that translate? Because just in my head thinking, you know, when other seed companies have added whatever trait, you know, it's another $10 for this stack, another $10 for this stack. You know, I could see them wanting to do that. Like, oh, we're going to add another $10 because now this sequestering part. So they might do that. Or is that something that you're trying to kind of steer them away from through the licensing package? Or do you not really care how they do that in a sense? How does that work?
I have pretty strong feelings. I wouldn't say never, but we have pretty strong feelings that this is going to be the best monetization system for every entity along the chain. We could charge for it more. The thing about the deep roots is they will very likely really pay off in times of stress. So we don't necessarily think there's going to be a huge yield benefit to it, but there will probably be reduced yield loss. So when there's a drought and you lose 10 bushels, you might only lose 5. So that's a harder thing to charge for too, because it's like, well, how much money did I save you versus money that I gained you? That's just a different mentality. So that's how we're looking at it. And we're pretty tightly affiliated to this because ultimately it's going to make the best for everyone involved. And we can capture way more value on the backside, and also get those benefits to the farmers of, you know, we're seeing more stress. There's more climate change. There's more issues. And whether you believe in it or not, you can see it everywhere. You can see warmer temperatures. You see less rain in a lot of areas. You see more rain in certain spots. So it's really interesting. When I had a year in between Rantizo and Sequesta, I had to travel quite a bit, and I wasn't planning on it, but I happened to go to a bunch of places where the effects of climate change were really, really obvious. I went down to Antarctica. I saw a spot that had 35 feet of ice that was now bare ground. So in the last 40 years, 35 feet of ice have disappeared from that spot.
Great.
I saw a place in Europe that there were ski lifts and, you know, everything. And they said, oh, yeah, we don't have a mountain anymore. We don't have skiing anymore. The mountain's obviously there, but we don't get enough snow. So the ski lift was built like in the 60s or 70s. There's not enough snow there anymore to make that work. So whether you like it or not, those things are happening. So we don't debate that. We don't fight with people about it, but it just, we're going to solve this problem and keep working it.
So, you know, you're trying to do this through the gene editing process. Are you dabbling into ways on other ways to get roots deeper, thicker, from even like the biological side or other methods? Because, you know, some crops are not going to be gene edited just because of what they are and whatnot. But I'm assuming you're looking at some other methods of implementing the same thing.
Absolutely. So the measurement reporting verification, MRV system, that can be used for any deep rooting technology. If it's a microbial application, if it's, you know, an additive, whatever you're doing, we can quantify that. And we're actually talking to a range of groups about being their verification partner just so they can monetize appropriately. So that is something that we're designing our system to be able to enable others to use. We're looking specifically at gene editing and specifically in commodity crops because it's a moderate amount of work with a gigantic payout because of the scale of commodity crops. So we'll start with covercress, then we'll go to soybeans and canola. So we'll learn some things in a smaller crop, covercress, figure out a lot of stuff out there, get kind of the systems working, and then go to soybeans and canola. And then the plan is to move on. We're not super focused on any specialty crops just because of the pure acreage. Someone was asking me about, you know, do you want to do tomatoes? And I know these numbers, but there's 300,000 acres of tomatoes in the United States. In one county in Iowa, there's 99 counties in Iowa, there's 300,000 acres of corn. So like we could go all the work, do everything in tomatoes, everything else, and have this tiny, tiny opportunity, or we could get into corn and, you know, hundreds or thousands of times more opportunity there.
Yeah. I mean, I could see some other, I mean, there's certain other crops like, well, I mentioned sunflowers earlier. There is some gene editing there. It's a little different. Sugar beets, that's another area, and that's a decent size and it's a high value crop, but yeah, you can't touch everything, and that's okay as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And
there's plenty to grab.
Yeah, we'll be doing gene editing, which is different than gene modification. Maybe to explain for the audience, gene editing is taking a trait from one version of a soybean and putting it into an elite soybean. So you've got a natural thing that's there moving along. It's indistinguishable from natural breeding. You could have done it by just combining those two plants together. It's a much faster way to do it. You can shave years off your production.
Is that using some of the CRISPR methods?
Exactly. Okay. Yep. And then gene modification is taking a trait from any source and then putting it in a crop. So it's something from a jellyfish going into a soybean, something from a herbicide resistant insecticide resistant insect, putting that into corn, and then that's how you get BT and other things like that.
Well, and that's what has scared the world, especially Europe and other places. So I do see the CRISPR method is, I mean, it's still anything you say gene whatever scares certain people. Although it just still makes me, I almost have to, you have to laugh about it with some of those methods, people don't want it. And then, think of COVID and all the vaccines that came out, and they're using all these newer methods. And then, but you have people that are totally for, changes in gene editing, farmers that are then scared of maybe vaccines or something, and vice versa from the environmental side. Oh, we don't want this, but we want this. And beyond getting into the pure politics of it, it's, you just have to laugh at it almost just because of,
I don't want to get into politics, but one of my favorite stories, this was during the election, was I think it was in Michigan. Somebody was ahead and they were saying, stop the count. And so everybody wanted to put the count to stop. And then somebody else was ahead in Arizona and they're like, we got to count all the votes. We got to count the votes. Like, wait a minute.
Yeah, which one is it?
You want to stop or accelerate depending on who's winning. And so you have no principle there. It's just, who do we want to win? So those things happen all the time. And we choose not to get involved with it. And just sometimes got to take a step back.
And it's possible you're probably just what we were doing at some point in time, hopefully not, that you'll piss some environmental group off or some sort of group and you're like, well, it is what it is. You just have to deal with the science and use the science.
I think if you're moderately ticking many groups off, that means you're doing pretty well. Like if somebody's absolutely outraged, all right, then maybe they have a point. But if everyone is slightly miffed, you're probably on a pretty good path. So because people are generally happy with the status quo, so you got to change just enough to not make them too angry.
Yeah. Well, and, in any method I think more approaches like you're trying to do here is kind of maybe what others in ag tech or dealing with anything in tech is. I mean, I've dealt more on software. You've done some of that or the drones. Now you're getting into the gene side. Like you just gotta be really smart about how you are applying that to the whole production system. And that's maybe what many have thought they were doing. They've come up with something and said, oh yeah, this will work everywhere. It's like, well, yeah, that doesn't work everywhere. And if you try to say it works everywhere, then you get yourself in trouble. So you're not saying it works everywhere currently. So that's, I think, going after where you need to go after.
Yeah, there'll be certain situations where this is excellent and you make a beachhead in that market and show that, this is going to be a better way to do it. And then you expand from there. So we did that at Rantiza, land and expand strategy. These are the things in, commodity crop fungicide application in rainy areas. A drone is really good when it rains a lot at the end of July and you're trying to spray fungicide in corn and soy and you can't get in the field. So that's a great opportunity. And that's kind of where we started. Now we've got hubs set up in different parts of the country where, we're doing some pasture land spraying. We're doing some, specialty crop spraying in the Pacific Northwest. All those things kind of come together and this is fundamentally better in this situation. And then we find more and more situations where that is. Same thing at Sequest. returning soybeans. Like there's going to be benefit for the people that plant it in certain situations. Like there's, you know, a lot of climate stress around you. All right, this is going to be a better way to do it. And then we kind of expand from there.
Well, and I see just from my, like we were saying earlier, my variable rate application roots of things. I mean, I've been kind of surprised some of the multi-hybrid, multi-variety planting hasn't taken off as far as I thought. But of course, there's a data play and data side to that.
Yep.
But in a sense, if it was tied more to more knowledge on what's actually happening with those varieties, say what kind of what you're doing, it's like, hey, these roots are going down here. I could maybe check off that other box too. That's just kind of that extra benefit.
Yeah.
Like, hey, okay, this area, this, you know, this low lying area, it's got heavier vegetation, but there's more water there. Yeah, we can, this variety really pushes deep and soaks up a lot of water here because there's excess, where top of a hill, you might not even put that type of variety there because it's just, it's, or maybe you need it to go deeper because they're to get the water. I mean, I guess it depends on the lay of the land, soil types and all that, but.
We were just at Bex and they showed us, they're making these root boxes, which are really, really cool. So it's gravel, kind of like what's on a baseball field. Like you grow the plant in that and it grows a whole season. So you get the whole, they put it up, they fertigate all the nutrients in and everything else. So it grows just like normal. And then you can pull the sides away and all the soil, the gravel parts fall out. So you can just see all the roots that are there. It's really, really cool. It's a phenomenal visualization. They call them root boxes. And it's amazing to see. So they showed us one that was, they call it a racehorse. And it was just like, if the conditions are right, this corn is going to yield like crazy. It'll be amazing. You can see like a very narrow root pattern, deep, you know, going in the, on the edges that going out. And then they had another that was way bushier, like much more lateral roots. And like, this is a very safe, it's going to grow well in any conditions, but it's, you know, not going to be probably more than 200 some bushels. Like, so figuring out those exact same things, like, yeah, you put your racehorse here, you put your Toyota Camry here, you know, like that's how it goes. And you kind of figure those things out, but that gets to, you know, what AI can do. Like, I think that's more data than humans can process.
Yeah, no, I would agree.
But like, that's where, understanding all that and then saying, yep, precisely in this spot, which kind of, it gets to the same thing I was doing at Rantizo, like precisely what right here, what's the best thing you can do. And then 4 feet away, 20 feet away, 2 miles away, it's a different thing. And then you just optimize for that. So I think those are exciting problems and I'll keep working on them and solve them.
I've even been, you know, talking to a few more recently too, is, you know, as like I said, I've kind of been around the more of the, you know, kind of the data agronomic side of, you know, applying, you know, using data and actually making actionable insights in the field. And it's honestly, there's still not enough people that do it. And there's varying reasons for that. I even think in the last, called 10 years from the amount of money that has been coming in and all that type of stuff, that we almost kind of got away from some of that stuff because, you know, then big data, all this other data, we got to just do something with the data, manage the data better. And so all these tools came out to kind of try to do that. And we almost forgot about what we actually want to do with the data and how we actually want to utilize it and apply it in the field to actually change something. Mm-hmm. It's been more of this mantra of, well, let's just get it and put it somewhere and then we'll kind of combine it and then we'll just say, here it is. And most people were not actually like doing something with it. I do though have this feeling, and just I've heard been more and more other people talking about it. I think what you're doing too makes it flows into that. It's like, all right, we've talked about all this shit for the last 10 years of what data is and where it can be placed. Better at it now than we were. Now let's actually do something. Let's actually make a move. Let's bring in these efficiencies. Let's make it easier for farmers. You know, to your point, you know, maybe AI can help on that because there's so much data. Mm-hmm. And like a post I did earlier today, it was kind of, you know, the frustrations with software. Well, probably one of the biggest things that can help just with software adoption and usage is just to make it easier for a random person to go in there, say what they want, type what they want, like you can kind of do in ChatGPT now, and it gives you what you want. You don't have to press all the buttons in the software. You don't have to do all the things. You're like, just do it for me. And
I'm from Darrysville, Iowa, which is where Field of Dreams was filmed. So, you know, the line from the movie, if you build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people are doing with data and a lot of things in agriculture. We're just going to build this, and people come in. That works in movies, but doesn't really work well in real life. You've got to add value. And that's where a lot of times, you know, I was looking at companies doing this, you know, 5-10 years ago of, you know, it's $15-$20 worth of data processing and inputs and everything else. And we might get you another bushel. So it's like, oh, I spent $20 to get five. And you wonder why investment is drying up. And, you know, those things don't make sense. But now the processing is cheaper. The insights are more. Maybe you're spending $3 to get 5 or 8 or whatever it is. And that's where we've had a fair bit of success fundraising here. Actually, one of the reasons I'm excited for the timing on this is we've announced a $6 million seed round, which is a pretty good sized seed round. And
I would say that is that's bigger than a seed. That's like a plant round. I think you've got the plant to grow a little bit.
Exactly.
No one's going to change the name to that, but I'm just throwing it out there.
But doing it in this environment, this is a really difficult fundraising environment. And it's pretty fantastic to get support from, you know, quality investors and have the team growing. And then, you know, we're looking to hire people for our plant transformation group that's being built up in St. Louis. So really excited about what's happening here at Sequesta.
Well, I mean, clearly you're on that side of it, on the early stages of it, because anything gene changes in plants is, as we all know, they're fairly spendy ventures to get in. And that's where actually, you know, there's been a lot of, you could say, crap thrown on VCs in the ag tech world. I've done it plenty myself, but there's always a fit for them too, for bigger, you know, bigger things that just need more because they're bigger processes and ideas. It fits too. So
yeah,
I guess talking about, what's your kind of overall thoughts on where that world is? Cause you've been dealing with the investment side, like how that sits, like, cause so much has changed just in the last year.
Well, I think there's a really big disconnect with farmers are used to very slow returns, patiently waiting out things, grinding on 2-5% per year, having a negative year every so often, hopefully not too frequently, and then just build slowly, slowly, slowly. And the VC model of making 10 bets, 7 of them are zeros. And, you know, 1 or 2 are huge, 1 or 2, you know, make their money back or something else. That's kind of just different mindsets. And I know I was talking to it was an early stage ag VC, like smart people, but they had someone on their investment committee of like volunteers, and he was a controller at a small manufacturing facility. And he's like, don't you have any, you know, like low risk, high return investment opportunities? Like, no,
that's not how ag works.
You go to a bank and like that's not early stage VC. Like that, so it's just like a mentality of, well, it's a different mindset. So that's where I think you need all of them. I mean, frankly, you need, you know, these software things that are going to pay off in a big way with very little, you know, scaling costs. You need, and the other thing in agriculture is ultimately you're moving stuff. Like you're moving a seed, you're moving a fertilizer, you're moving a chemical. It's got to get manufactured somewhere. It's got to get delivered somewhere. It's got to get sprayed, applied, planted, whatever it is. So when you're in the stuff moving business, there's hardware and everything else, and people don't like to invest in that, especially on the VC side, because it's hard to do. So like most of those investments are software to make the stuff moving go better, you know, and that's how it goes.
Well, they want the copy. It's kind of the, you know, we make it once and then we can copy it a million times and charge the same amount. And I suppose you can, in a sense, do that for the gene side of things that you're doing, and that's where it's kind of a more of a novel approach to making money.
They're called genome-wide association studies. So I can find, the common gene in canola and soybean and Arabidopsis and other things. And like, okay, what I found there, I can do move on to the next one. But I was going to tell the story of when we were in, I was doing corporate BC, and someone would come in and say, we're the Amazon of ag chemicals. We're the Uber of farm equipment. I was like, oh, you're telling me you don't have a unique idea. You're just applying someone else's idea to a new market, a new vertical. And so, like, all right, you can do those things, but that's not really truly innovative. And there's those businesses can work and they're fine, but they're not going to be like a monster that's going to get a huge, huge return. So that's where you've got to think a little bit more outside the box.
I mean, naturally, like every industry, ag has had challenges, especially, lately, is, someone creates something, gets a little traction, and then you get like 20, 30 copycats of doing variations of the same. And to me, that's always been, I mean, it's a natural thing of business. It's expected, if anything. But what I see is always the hard problems are the hard problems for the hard reasons they are. And those, the people that go after those things, that's what separates, I think, kind of the, they call it the men from the boys in the ag sector. So if you don't go after some of those big questions, those harder things, you can't set your own stage for bigger success if you just kind of create the same thing everybody else has done. There's variation to that, but.
No, I see that completely. And sometimes when people copy my ideas or I see them copying things, like it burns you a little bit, makes you mad. Like, oh, I'm just copying what we're doing. But it is a little compliment too of, oh yeah, you're like literally trying to do the same business that we started 6 years ago. Okay. Like that's great. I'm glad that's been proven out and it's kind of fun to be there.
Well, nothing wrong with competition too. It kind of lights a fire under your ass and gets you going. And what is good, and I've noticed this even from the imagery side, because now there's like hundreds of people that deal with it on with satellites and whatnot, is you get others in, they do start innovating in different ways that you weren't even expecting. Like, oh well, actually that's a good way to go about that, or that's a different niche that you couldn't handle, but they applied some of the same tech. So you got to kind of be mindful of of that at times too, which
Yeah,
is
we're pretty
hard.
open in terms of partnerships. I've always been that way because, thinking that it's generally better to have other bigger groups along with you. If people want to partner with you, it shows that you're doing something right. If you have to go alone, you're probably not on to like a really big game-changing idea. So we're looking for carbon partners at Sequesta, groups that want to do some forward purchases. What we're seeing a lot of these CPG companies, a lot of the food
Sure,
companies,
makes sense.
they've made public pledges about we're going to reduce our carbon emissions. And frankly, the majority of them have no idea how they're going to hit those targets. So the ability to use a deep root trait that will lower the carbon intensity of many of their feedstocks can be really, really advantageous. So that's the type of things that we're looking for, groups that are trying to partner up on that side. Obviously, farmers, that want to do trials. We got a lot of people that reach out and we're still building that network. So excited for when we've got a lot of products for them to be able to try. And then we've got a full seed round, but you're always looking for new investors and trying to see what other opportunities may pop up.
Yeah, for anyone listening out there that has a lot of money, Michael's looking for, always going to be looking for probably more money because he's dealing with gene editing.
Yeah,
So
it's expensive.
it's
Expensive.
expensive. It just
Yeah.
is. So I mean, with it, what's the timetable of some of these things actually getting out to market,
Yeah,
like on
we're
at
probably
scale or at somewhat of scale?
2 years away from getting, some cover crop seeds out that have been edited, and then probably 3 to 5 years away from your commodity crops, soybeans and canola. And so you're not in Canada, but you're close. So I'm heading up to the Agritech Venture Forum in Toronto because we're going to do some work in canola. And I think given what's happening in Canada in particular, there's a really good opportunity there where they've got a lot of canola. They're forward thinking
Yes.
on the carbon markets. And now their government just announced a program where they'll be buying carbon credits. So all those things coming together, it's like, oh, we might be spending a little more time up north. So
I used to live in the canola capital of the United States in northern North Dakota. So you'll have to.
All right.
You'll have to come up here again. I think you've been up here a few times in different
ways. Oh, yeah. Well, there's a big wrestling tournament in Fargo that I would go with my son.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. So,
yeah.
So yeah. Just come here during this winter was mild, but yeah, come during the summer.
Oh, I grew up in Iowa. No, we're all fine here. We can get through some snow and ice.
You get our weather once in a while in spurts. So,
yes.
And it's funny, I think you maybe mentioned it before. You said you were from Dyersville, and that's where the National Farm Toy Museum is too. I was there with my boundary stuff, showing off my play rugs to all the kids. And
oh yeah,
it's always fun going back to Dyersville. I've been there a few times and seeing all the that side of it.
We served a lot of food. We had a restaurant, so when the farm toy show would come in, we were very, very busy. That was a big deal. So. Yeah, always good. They had a couple shows per year, and always fun to see. All right, this is it amazed me at the time, not realizing it, all the differences in, you know, the little thing, the things you can put on a tractor with the lift arms and that, and everything else. It's people love it. It's very interesting.
I've even thought in my head, because some of the people that build customized farm toys and all that, it's like there's so much passion and intricacy in building these things and planning for some of them. We need like some of those people to transfer into ag tech to use that same kind of mindset in. Be like, just really get into the weeds and all that. Mm-hmm. But I know I said earlier this might be a little shorter one podcast because I have to run, even though it's a Friday and all that. And we got a few more minutes. What are some other, I mean, from the larger scope of things, because you've been in the, you know, you've seen a lot in the ag tech side in the last, you know, umpteen years. What are some other things that are exciting you in kind of the space, even though we're kind of in a weird lull? What are some things that are exciting you, and what are some things that maybe you'd like to see change a little bit? Because there's a need for changing some of the processes too.
Yeah, I think the systems level integrations, those things I think are really interesting. And you see somebody like a Leaf being able to just make it work for everyone. Like that technology is really cool. And like everyone has that need, you know, connect APIs. And I know enough to be dangerous there, but those things are really interesting and appealing. Things that kind of work with the existing products and make them better. That's pretty exciting to me. And then I think on the biologic side, it's really interesting how there's gigantic improvements sometimes. And then learning, why did it happen? Where can we put it out? How can we make it more frequent successes? And then those opportunities are pretty exciting, you know, throwing data at it, throwing variable rate application or variable location application, you know, all those things like that's pretty exciting there. So those are the things that pop to mind of stuff that's interesting. So I'm also hopeful that the big groups that have raised a lot of money, we need like a real success there because there's been a lot of junk that has come out.
Yeah.
So we need something, you know, more along a Blue River-ish type of climate type of big deal that turns out to be valuable and actually work, as opposed to others that have had lots and lots of investment and they're still floundering to find not product market fit, but a product.
Well, I think I could name exactly who that is right now. Yeah. There's a few maybe too, but no, I'd agree. There is a need for, I mean, I have my own, I guess, thoughts on some of the groups that have made some of those big exits, which some have changed kind of the nature of things. Some have also changed the nature of things while they maybe shouldn't have never been paid that amount of money after what kind of goes down. It depends, but
no, I agree. Like, would you pay those prices now? And, you know, a lot of times those are defensive things that, you know, a big acquirer is doing, like, yeah, it was more expensive, but had they continued to exist and erode our market share, That's you know, it's ultimately more valuable for them. So a thing that we're looking at Sequesta, you know, adding this trait into a crop and giving, you know, a deep root slash sequestration opportunity that's free, that could change some points in market share of like, oh, I can buy the same thing that I've always bought, but if I have this opportunity to get a deeper root, all right, that's something that I want to try. And you know, people will check that out. And, you know, moving market share in the seed business is giant, giant.
Oh, yeah, that's
$66 billion worth of seed sold every year. So if you're sliding a percentage point or two from one big company to the other big company, that's substantial dollars. So that's where we think our value will be in terms of, you know, how the how this could be marketed.
Well, I think you got something on your shoes worth walking towards. So I think you should be good. That's, you know, my analogy for the day. I don't know if that makes sense, but and at any point, you know, just from being on here, I'll take 1% of the company, you know, whatever. The Perfect. Future's good, so we'll sign the contract tomorrow. But like I said, this one we'll run it a little short. It'll be under an hour. My first one under an hour, which is maybe where I should be most of the time, because even though I've done ones close to 2 hours, that's a lot.
It podcast. Is. Yeah. I'll admit I really enjoyed the one with Carter, but I did listen to it at 1.25 speed because I saw how long it was. So
that's So it's a good test to try to hone it in a little bit. But naturally, we could probably talk another hour anyways and record the whole thing because there's plenty to fun things to talk about. But Michael, thanks for coming on, and we'll kind of close it up. But thanks for being on my Ag Uncensored podcast. And I think for anyone listening there, keep track of what he's doing, because it's a different way to think about the carbon credit stuff, and in a more, I'd say, usable way that people don't see, which sometimes those are the best scalable things that can kind of sit in the background and create value. So I applaud you for going after something different. As we talked, always hard to do.
Well, thank you. And we have a saying that we like to kind of wrap things up with, that at Sequesta, we think carbon is a problem and we're running it into the ground.
I think people would like that saying, because I think people want to run it into the ground in different ways. You're just trying to do it in the positive way that everyone actually wants to. So
exactly.
So, it's like we'll do the underground work. You're subsurface. You won't see the benefits. You won't even know we're there. You know,
exactly.
We're doing such a good a job. You don't even know we're there. So something like that. But anyways, thanks again. And we'll definitely, like I said, keep track of what Michael's doing, and hopefully we'll get some questions and some thoughts from after I spread it out and get other people's thoughts and feelings, which I'm sure will be positive, but. You got a long road, but a good road to travel on. So
thank you. Great seeing you again.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael. And thanks everyone for listening to this episode, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.